Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Spin the Rally Pod. I am Luke Barry, Dirtfish's deputy editor, a new voice to the podcast. Thankfully, I'm joined by somebody you will know. Robert Reid sits opposite me. Robert, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
We know what today is. Today marks 20 years since you won the 2001 World Rally Championship. Does it feel like 20 years ago?
I think in some ways it feels like 50 years, and in some ways it feels like 2 years. I mean, you know, it does seem a while ago, but, you know, in the same token, the memories are still there. You know, it was a wonderful day, slightly bittersweet by the fact that we lost Richard 4 years to the day later. So it's always one of these kind of slightly strange days, but you know, really good to reflect back on, you know, what was an amazing you know, outcome and something that Richard and I worked towards for a large number of years and eventually succeeded in achieving.
How often do people mention the famous moment where he grabs your arm and shouts that you're the best in the world? It must be quite a common gag.
Yeah, it is. But no, it's nice. I mean, you know, I mean, I think you see in those moments, and I think with rally in particular, you see a lot of that raw emotion. You know, the guys in single seaters or racing cars, you know, it's not so easy in the middle of a competition for somebody to stick a mic or a camera or have an onboard, you know, a camera running when there's interaction happening. So I think it's, you know, it's one of the nice things. And, you know, we've all seen moments over the years with various crews, but yeah, it's really nice that, you know, that was what was on Richard's mind at that particular moment. What was on my mind was just getting from the end of the last stage to the final control, checking in, getting rid of the time card, doing all the official stuff. So, you know, whilst everybody kind of thinks the end of the last competitive stage is you've won and that's it, then certainly as a co-driver, there was a fair bit more still to do.
Yeah, I think that answer is very typical of most co-drivers. They don't tend to relax until everything's done. But we will get into Rally GB, of course, the famous finale, a little bit later on. Just to start, Robert, well, if I can ask for a bit of context for where you and Richard were before 2001, because obviously, this was the first year with a new car, but it was your third year with Subaru. And I understand you had a bit of a three-year plan to try and win the championship, which you ultimately did. But can you just give us an idea of where you were after the year 2000 heading into 2001?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was a three-year plan. I mean, I think it was a 10-year plan or an 11-year plan from when I started, you know, with Richard. But certainly the first year at back at ProDrive at Subaru in 99, we probably didn't really realise where we were going to be. You know, we had some good results, we won some events, and it was quite clear at the end of that year that we could, you know, we were capable of putting together a championship bid. 2000, again, had gone well. The 2000 car was introduced, unfortunately, just for 9 events. But, you know, really came in with a bang, was quicker than we'd had before, and you know, was a step up. And I think for me personally, not winning the championship in 2000 was a real bitter blow, as much because we did what we could in the last round and it wasn't enough.
Yeah,
somebody else did more. So, you know, I think that was a bitter blow for me. So we regrouped and we came with a new car at the start of 2001, full of hope and expectation.
Obviously, the 2000 Impreza was probably one of the most competitive cars you'd ever sat in. Is that fair to say? So, going to the new car, what was the initial testing like? And did you and Richard feel that it was an improvement on the car you'd had the year before?
I don't think I can say even on a podcast what Richard's first words when he drove the car was. He wasn't as impressed as perhaps some people were hoping he would be. No, I think it's fair to say that, you know, and I've read since that ProDrive were slightly disappointed that they had to come with the new car, but the models had changed and, you know, there was pressure to do so from Subaru from Japan. The 2000 car was a good car. We probably hadn't realised all the potential out of it, so it was disappointing that it was retired sort of early in its lifespan. The 01 car was disappointing, is probably a bit of a strong word, but yeah, it just didn't feel right. The engine didn't feel great to begin with. We had some reliability issues, so it was disappointing to start off the year it felt like a couple of steps back from where we'd finished the year before.
Yeah, okay. And for context, obviously, as well, at this time, he had Marcus Grönholm and just won the championship. That's who had beaten Ewan Richard to that title. He was still at Peugeot. I think Didier Auriol had joined, so that was different. But Colin, Carlos, Tommy, they were all in the same team and broadly the same car. So that, I guess, was a bit of a disadvantage for you guys as well.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you know, developing a new car is always a tricky thing. And, you know, I just, when you see that whole year, and I know we'll kind of talk in more detail about bits of it, but, you know, we didn't have the best of times at times during the year. But you look at our teammates, you know, look at Petter and Marco, and they both had worse years than we had. Well, clearly we won, so we had a better year. But, you know, even in terms of results and retirements and whatever. So, yeah, it was a bit of an uphill slog.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So Monte Carlo, we'll start at the beginning and start, I guess, at the bottom, because I think, was it maybe five or six stages in, and you think you were maybe fourth overall? Someone can correct me on that if I'm wrong. You might be able to remember, I'm not sure. But I think it was around fourth, and then obviously the car broke down. So that was a major disappointment to start the year, I guess.
Yeah, it was the end of the first leg. So coming back into Monte Carlo, coming up the hill from on the motorway, just before you turn off to go down into Monte Carlo, and it just literally dropped from four cylinders to three cylinders to two cylinders and one cylinder, and we parked it up at the toll booth and that was it. So yeah, very disappointing. But I mean, we'd, you know, Marco had retired on the run out to the first stage in the morning, so I mean it was a not a great day for the team, and obviously disappointing to leave the first round with no points.
So up next, of course, as traditional, is Sweden. And this one, to be fair, the pace here was remarkable, actually, particularly after what happened. But I'll let you explain, I guess, how it went wrong to start with.
Yeah, well, it was fairly typical for us in Sweden. Stick it in a snowbank early on and then have a storming recovery drive. So I think I've still got frostbite scars on my fingers from competing in Sweden and trying to dig cars out of the snow. But yeah, we just went straight on, kind of up on the skate road in the snow, got stuck, had to dig it out, and then we're fighting back. And I think in some ways the number of fastest times we then did was spurred on by the fact that Marco was desperate to get his first fastest time ever on a WRC event, and a couple of times he thought he'd done it. And then we came along and pipped him by a couple of tenths or something. So I think there was a fairly big... Richard was taking his... he was taking his motivation from stopping Marco having the fastest time at that point.
That's quite interesting to hear, because I think... I'm going to go on a slight tangent here, Robert, but I think the relationship between Richard, Marco, yourself and Beef is often forgotten about by a lot of people, because you... Obviously, I think a lot of people forget you were, first of all, teammates for that year, but secondly, that you all did... seemed to get on really well.
Yeah, and I mean, it went back to Peugeot Challenge. I mean, the first year that I did rallies with Richard in 91, Beef was co-driving for a guy called Steve Bennett in the Challenge, and we were all mates together, you know, amateurs playing it, going rallying, going off to Ardennes in Belgium and having adventures and, you know, doing events all over the UK. So it was a really good time. And when we progressed, I mean, Beef actually helped us, as did Phil Mills, actually. helped us the following year in 92 when we did the national championship, just coming and doing a bit of on-event coordination with us, with the group NCAR at that time. And I saw a video, one of these kind of video to online things on some of the social platforms recently, which was the last round of the national championship when we won. And David Williams, who helped Richard and I throughout our career, is there, and Beef stood there as well in a team jacket as the team coordinator for the day. So yeah, I mean, we went back a long way. And then when Beef started co-driving with Marco, first in the Toyota, obviously, we were all mates and kind of hung out. And then Marco and Beef joined the team for 2001.
Okay, so tangent averted, back on track to the season. Next was obviously Portugal, quite a famous rally, mainly for how, I don't know what the right word to use here is, because my immediate reaction was to swear. Quite a torrid, sodden event. Have you ever competed in anything that was as much of a mud bath, I guess, as that rally?
It was pretty bad. I mean, it was survival. I can't remember where we finished, but it was survival.
I've got it down as fourth overall. Again, yeah. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong.
But. Yeah, no, it could easily be. But, you know, I remember one particular stage, a repeated stage, you know, and it was, we were waiting to start the stage because so many cars had gone off the road. And Natalie Barrett at the time with Roger Freeman had gone off the road, and they were walking out the stage, and they both looked like some, you know, people that had been through like the most extreme SES assault course you can ever imagine. I mean, absolutely drenched from head to toe and covered in mud. I mean, it was really horrible conditions.
What's that like to sort of compete in as opposed to any other rally? Because you've got the job to do still and everybody's facing the same thing, but when you're in that situation, particularly as you were, when you needed to get some points on the board, how hard can you afford to push, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, you can't force it, but also you can't just say, oh, this is really tough, I won't bother on this event and wait till the next one. So, you know, I think it's always a balance. And, you know, at that point, third event in, not many points on the board, I think we'd have been throwing caution to the wind to some degree, but safe in the knowledge that, you know, another zero score wouldn't have been very helpful at that point. But, you know, in terms of those conditions, absolutely right. I mean, you know, I can think of umpteen different events. I mean, back to doing Asia Pacific when, you know, the mud seems even more slippy out there than it does in Portugal or in the UK. But certainly, you know, I mean, Richard was no stranger to a muddy, wet, horrible Rally GB. So, you know, it's certainly conditions you had to be able to survive in.
Yeah, okay. So Portugal, obviously, Tommy Mäkinen won that round. He had also won the Monte, so that I think gave him 20 points at this stage. You had about 3, so you're already on a bit of a back foot, but the way the point system works, of course, then was the top 6 positions that scored. And the next round, I think you were 7th in Spain, so you just missed out on a point. After that event, obviously you're 4 rounds in, there's still plenty to go, but does the head drop? Do you get worried that this might not happen for you, or you're always optimistic that there will be a turnaround at some stage?
I think Rich's focus was always to win championships. So yes, of course, that is, you know, the big thing that you're concentrating on. But there's other stuff, you know, there's developing the car, there's setting fastest times, there's winning rallies. So I don't think it ever gets to the point of, you know, throwing your hands in the air and saying, you know, this is not going to work, let's concentrate on next year. I mean, Richard was, a couple of times people, you know, said to Richard over his career, you've been really lucky, you've always ended up in the best car. And he was always very quick to correct them and say, well, do you not think that part of my skill as a driver was making sure I was in the right place at the right time? And that I had the skill to develop the car and make it the best car. So, you know, I think that was also something that motivated Richard, you know, working with the engineers, working with the team, and just really trying to get the car where we wanted it. And we knew, you know, Richard was the type of driver that it wasn't about beating people for him, it was about doing the best job he could do. And he knew that if he got to the end of a stage, having done a perfect job, he would be fastest. If he got to the end of an event, having done a perfect job, he would win the event. So I think it was about, you know, improving himself constantly and knowing that, you know, he'd had a bad four rallies, but didn't make him a driver.
Yeah, that's a fair point, because he has always seemed like a driver to me anyway. I wasn't around the WRC at this time, but he would find a way to compete almost with himself rather than being motivated by having to beat somebody else. And that is quite rare in a rally driver then and now.
Yeah, I mean, yes and. I mean, I think, you know, in different sports and, you know, different motorsport disciplines, but also in other different sports, you know, you'll get different people with different motivations, you know, whether they're motivated, you know, specifically to beat others or to be the best. And I think, you know, Rich's motivation to be the best was one of the driving forces, because it would mean that he would debrief win, lose or draw. And he would stay until, you know, God knows when at night on a test in order to improve, because there was always improvements to be made, you know, rather than, you know, getting to the end of the event, having won it and go, well, that's fine, I beat everybody else, I don't need to debrief. And you know, that's kind of two extreme sides to the situation. The downside of competing against yourself was that people who are like that tend to be perfectionists. And with perfectionism, you can tie yourself up in knots and never be content. And, you know, there has to be a happy medium where you say, okay, that's enough. And then you go and you compete.
Do you think your working style was similar to Richard's? I.e., would you consider yourself a perfectionist? And do you think that's why the partnership worked, or was it a little bit like chalk and cheese?
A bit of both, probably. I mean, I'm more, let's just get the job done. But I could understand and appreciate where Richard was coming from, and I could work with that. And, you know, people have been critical of Richard over the years. You know, he was really difficult to work with, he was this, he was that, he was the next thing. And he wasn't when you understood his motivation. But if you didn't understood or wouldn't let yourself understand his motivation, then yes, you could. And you've just got to look at pace notes. I mean, we had 28 different severities of corners. We would, you know, he would... I always used to hate it when he said, oh, I've had an idea with the notes. I'd say, oh, for goodness sake. Because I knew that was a whole year of pain, changing the whole, you know, that particular aspect of the note system in order to incorporate a new call or something new throughout that year. And you'd get to the end of 12 months and breathe a sigh of relief and think, oh, at least we can have some consistency for a while. And two events later, you get, oh, I've had an idea about the note system again. And, you know, our notes continually evolved until the day we stopped. And I'm sure had we continued beyond, they would have continued to evolve again. And that's not the same for some other people. You know, some people will get to, okay, this is consistent. You know, you're not trying any less hard, but you're probably just not looking for the edge in the same way. And a lot of that is down to personality and motivation.
Yeah, okay. So we'll move back into 2001. We're having a nice little diversity, which is good. I think that is interesting. Argentina was next, and this was probably your first big result of the season, because it was second, but it was behind Colin. And is it fair to say this one was kind of won on the first stage when Colin took such a massive lead at everybody? Was that kind of how it went?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we all knew that that was Colin's tactic. You know, if he could get a jump on people on stage one, and I can't remember the exact figures, but, you know, 20 something seconds out of everybody on stage one, and then we ended up second behind him, a couple of seconds less than he'd taken out of us, or round about what he'd taken us out of us in the first stage. So it was pretty eeksy-peeksy after that first stage. But, you know, to actually take that time back was always going to be really difficult. Argentina was an event that Richard really enjoyed, you know, went well on. I can't remember why we got caught out, but it sounds like everybody got caught out on that first stage. You know, Colin just decided that that's where he was going to attack, and he was going to take a risk there, and it paid off.
Yeah. So that was obviously the first podium of the year. You went and doubled up on that on the next round, I think, in Cyprus. It was Cyprus, just checking my notes. But this one was kind of a rally marred by road order tactics, and that would become a bit of a theme, I think, for the rest of the season, with where you position yourself at the end of day one. Because of course back then, it's not like you have now where the person in first starts at the back. If you led the rally after the first day, you were on at the start, at the head of the pack on the next day.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of kick back a bit there and argue that it wasn't necessarily marred by, but, you know, maybe it was enhanced by, I don't know. I mean, certainly for me, you know, what I enjoyed about rallying in those days was it was tactical, amongst other things. And it was, you know, not necessarily just driving flat out. You had to think about what you were doing. You had to, you know, make choices of a large number of tyres. It was less controlled than it is nowadays in terms of, you know, homogenised as it is now. So, yeah, I mean, it was always a factor. There was always a lot of calculations going on and trying to work out. And, you know, maybe you would try and drop some time. Maybe you would think, okay, I can go ahead. And, you know, it probably wasn't until the next year at Peugeot where, you know, number one on the door. So we end up running first in, you know, the first event, and for quite a few events during our time at Peugeot, we're first on the road, and you get good at it.
Mm.
And I think there was, you know, if everybody talks about regrets and what you might have done differently, I think if we'd kind of realised that you can get good at it rather than, you know, try to play tactics, just got on with it, then it would be interesting to see how things worked out.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because I think in this particular instance with Cyprus as well, you had the lead at the end of the second day, but you had Colin who had I can't remember if he dropped back or if he was already behind you, but he increased the gap between you anyway, and he just ended up coming past you on the third day. So it's interesting to hear that you reckon you could have refined that craft, because we see it now with drivers like Sebastian Ogier and how many times he just has to drive at the front, and he's a lot better at it than most of his rivals are.
Yeah, I mean, the more you do it, the better you get at it. I mean, Cyprus was always a difficult event, just low average speed, you know, very gravelly roads, not much air coming in the roof vents of the car. You know, it wasn't particularly pleasant. It was like sitting in a overly hot sauna for 3 days and trying to work at the same time. So, yeah, it was always a tough event. But, you know, at that point in the season, you know, second place was certainly better than we'd fared earlier on.
Yeah, it was an important renaissance, but obviously this ended up being the start of Colin's real attack. Because to me, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but looking back at it now, the season kind of felt like it had about 3/3. So there was like the Tommy portion at the start of the year, Colin in the middle, and then probably you and Marcus, to be fair, for the second half of the year. Marcus's start was just even worse than yours had been. So at this point, though, you are gathering momentum. So it kept you in the race, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the car's getting better. We're understanding more about it. We're, you know, able to be more competitive. So, yeah, I mean, I still think that, you know, I'm not sure. Yes, you've always got one eye on the championship, but, you know, I said before, you can't force things. And even with rally wins, I always say, you got to put yourself in a position where you can win, and it might or might not work in your favour. And that's just the way of it. You know, you got to do what you can, and sometimes you get the rub of the green, sometimes you don't get the rub of the green, and it works out in your favour, and sometimes it doesn't.
Speaking of not working out in favour, we do have two more rounds to talk about on gravel. First was Acropolis, the next was Safari, and unfortunately for you two, it was another pair of DNS. I think it was a transmission in the Acropolis and then suspension in Kenya. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, I think it was prop shaft.
Okay.
Because we'd had a problem with prop shafts in Cyprus, and we'd managed to get away with it and still keep the result. And then in Greece, it was towards the end. It was one of the stages on the last day, from memory. Yeah, it all seemed to be going fine. Greece was always an event that we could do well on. So I think going into particularly, you know, Cyprus, Greece, Safari, we would have thought, okay, there's a fair chance of winning at least one of them and being on the podium in all three. And that, you know, started well enough in Cyprus. Didn't really continue, obviously, with retirement in Greece. And then Kenya was just a complete disaster. I mean, the team worked out fairly quickly what the problem was, but, you know, Petter had the same problem. I think Toshi had the same problem as well. But for us on the first stage, we were parked up at the side and that was it. And it always seems worse than Safari because certainly in those days, really, really long event, lots of preparation. We were doing quite a lot of testing, so you were there quite a lot. It was later in the year than it'd usually been. Usually we went straight from Sweden to Safari. So, you know, it was a place that, you know, we managed to win there twice. And first WRC win as well. So, you know, it was somewhere that we'd obviously earmarked as being somewhere we could bag a haul of points and came away empty-handed.
Yeah, it wasn't looking too great at this point, but obviously, how much were you thinking about the next year? Because, well, we'll get into it, I guess, in a couple rounds' time, but at this stage, are you thinking about, is Subaru the right place for us to be? Is there a better opportunity elsewhere, or is this too early in the season to be thinking about these negotiations?
No, I think it was starting around then. I can't remember when the original advances came. I mean, we were approached rather than went looking at the time of the initial approach. So yeah, I mean, it's always in your mind as to whether you are in the right place. I mean, Peugeot was you know, as you say, particularly towards the end of the year, very dominant with Marcus. So the temptation was always there to look around and sit. We'd been at that point at Subaru coming up for 3 years. So, yeah, I think the results definitely play on your mind and, you know, affect those decisions.
Can you remember what things were like sort of behind the scenes at this time? Because I know Richard was always a very calculated driver and no professional athlete will ever look at a situation and just think they're done, because you're just not wired like that, even if the press and everybody else is thinking it. But after this rally, I can't remember what the points gap was, but you're a long way behind. Was there a change in approach after that, or was it everything just the same but some of the results picked up, if you get what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think it was everything was the same and the results just picked up. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you don't, you know, people have said, you know at what point were you almost giving up? Well, you don't give up. But also, you're in such a bubble. And I think you don't realise until you look back now. And whether that bubble is, you know, blind faith or calculated, you know, decision on the way things is going to go. But you've got to believe. You've got to believe that you're moving forward and that you can do something. Because, you know, I'm not a big believer in bad luck. I kind of believe you make your own luck. But sometimes it does seem a bit out of the blue when things keep happening all the time. But, you know, you've just got to keep pushing and you've just got to keep relying on the fact that, you know, everybody's going to have zero scores. And if it happens at the right time when you're scoring points at the end of the year, then everything's possible.
So next up was Rally Finland, where, of course, the year before you'd had quite a big and famous accident. Second overall here was actually a very, very good result. And I think Richard's pace in Finland is probably often forgotten, particularly now when you've got the likes of Chris Meek and Elvin Evans winning in Finland, and there's the statistic that they're the only British drivers to have done that. But Richard came close a lot of times to doing it and nearly did in 01 as well.
Yeah, and I mean, even 99, you know, I mean, a lot of people forget 98 was the first time we went to Finland. So, you know, 99 was only our second time in Finland. And we were, I don't know, around about 10 seconds or whatever it was behind Juha at the end. having never been any further back than that the whole time. So yeah, again, it's, you know, it's fast, it's precise, you know, it's everything that kind of you know, Richard was good at. It's good pace notes. So it did always work. And I think, you know, again, if we're kind of looking back, you know, that 2000 shunt, I think had we settled for second behind Marcus then, we could very well have gone on and won the championship. But that 0 points at that point in the year was kind of what did for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's always going to be in the back of your mind. I mean, you know, I think 2001 Finland, I think I'm right in saying we were fastest on the last stage to jump from third to second. And the last stage was Onenpoja.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that just kind of shows that, you know, we certainly had the pace in Finland. And as you say, I mean, you know, to beat Finns in Finland is difficult. And hats off to everybody that's done it. Certainly one of the ones on my bucket list that I would have quite liked to have won.
We can't tempt you back to do it.
No.
Another year coming.
I'd be too much of a handicap now.
Just to pick up on something you said there as well in reference to the 2000 accident, obviously we're looking at this all with benefit of hindsight, but was Richard the kind of driver that was taking those lessons on at the time? So you mentioned the drop points with the accident. Was he already aware of that and thinking, right, I can't do that again, this is where I need to improve, etc., etc.?
Yeah, I mean, he was his own harshest critic. So yeah, I mean, he was incredibly hard on himself for, you know, for making a mistake. I think we actually led the event momentarily at that point.
Yeah.
Because we'd taken enough out of Marcus on that stage to go into the lead of the event. And I remember clearing the stage on the radio, and Simon Cole, our engineer, when I said, you know, we've crashed, we're out, he said, yeah, we've got your time, that's great, well done guys, give us a shout 2Ks down the road. Like, no Simon, we've crashed, we're off the road. No, but I've seen your time. Yes, we crashed over the flying finish, the car is destroyed, that's it. Oh, so, you know, I mean, I think there was, even for the team, there was just kind of like an expectation that we were going to haul Marcus in, or certainly have a good fight from there, you know, there to the end. And yeah, unfortunately, there was a bit of ambition, I think, in the speed into that corner that didn't quite marry up with how much it tightened.
So moving from one fast rally to another, New Zealand, very different in profile, but equally fast, but a very big weekend for your championship, Robert, because obviously, famously now, everybody looks at that as the one victory you took, but it also had ramifications for what was happening next year, because things were sort of progressing behind the scenes with contracts.
Yeah, they were, and we actually, when we went and did the shakedown for New Zealand, we drove back to the hotel with our engineer, with Simon, and we told him on the way back that we were leaving. And so we'd made our mind up. It wasn't public knowledge at that point. And I think it wouldn't be for another couple of rallies. And it was interesting, his view, which was, okay, I was kind of expecting that, and actually I'm going to leave too. And Simon went to work in Formula One. So he's now with Mercedes Formula One. So, yeah, it was a big weekend, and it was kind of, you know, I almost feel slightly emotional about it, that we had decided to move on, but we still had a job to do. And I think, you know, that showed that the focus, even though we'd told our engineer what was happening before the rally started, that didn't change the focus of, you know, what we needed to do to go and win the event.
It might sound obvious to ask now, and I'm sure it's been sort of said elsewhere, but what were the key reasons for deciding to jump ship? Obviously, we talked about it already, the rise in Persia, but was there anything wrong with where you were, or was it just a sense of another opportunity that was too good to pass up on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always euros or dollars or whatever is getting waved in front of your nose. I think it's, you know, in some ways, Richard and I have both grown up post Group B, but kind of watching that whole kind of era and thinking, wow, Peugeot is just an, you know, an iconic brand in rallying, and it would be great to work with them and drive with Peugeot at some point. Because, you know, I think as a driver, you don't want to necessarily be defined by the car you've always driven, and you want to be in, you know, you want to experience other things. You know, we were both, okay, it wasn't a prime factor, but we were both quite keen to brush up schoolboy French, but then we realised that the mechanics all wanted to speak English, so that didn't really work as a reason. But you know, the Peugeot, when you looked at it, I mean, we'd competed against Marcus as far back as 97 in Portugal, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, we knew we could beat him. You know, he wasn't sort of so much better, as it were. And the car was obviously, the Peugeot was obviously very good. You know, from what we'd seen, it had a very strong engine. So I think there was a number of factors, plus being disillusioned where we were. Just because, you know, the goal was to win the championship, and that didn't really look like it was going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So New Zealand, the event itself, another slight tactical battle with Colin, wasn't it, this one? But obviously you came out on top this time. Was there anything about that weekend that was, and it sounds like a cliche question to ask you, but was there anything about it that was better than other weekends, or was it just the result ended up going the way that arguably other rallies could have done?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, it was always interesting going to the long haul events. They always seemed more fun. You went earlier, you had a couple of nights out, it was, you know, you were more relaxed. New Zealand, particularly for a Scot, is actually feels quite homely. The roads are great, the people are great. So it was always a really good place to go. And I think that sets you up well. You interact with other drivers because you're there for longer. So, you know, I think the crack, as they would say in Ireland, between Richard and Colin was probably ongoing, certainly all the way through the recce, you know, just as to what tactics they were going to play. And, you know, at the end of the first day, we'd had a bit of a technical problem, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't slow us that much. But we decided that it wasn't in our interest to go out from the front and make a break. So we ended, I think it was 47 seconds or something behind Colin at the end of the first day. And Colin and Richard were having a go at each other. Richard was saying, oh, you've not got a big enough lead, McRae. And McRae was like, oh, you'll never catch me, Burnsy. And so there's a bit of that going on. First stage, next day, we were in the lead. And we got 42 or 43 or something up on him. And then it was role reversal the next night at the end of the day, you know. Colin saying, oh, that's never enough. I'll whip your ass tomorrow, Burnsy. But the last day was predominantly in Maramarua Forest, which rutted rather than cleaned. So we were confident that that was enough. I think Richard said he the minimum that he wanted was 40. If he didn't have 40, he'd rather drop back. And we ended up with 42. So we were kind of marginal on our calculation. And Colin got with two or three stages to go, got within 15 and made a mistake and went off the road and lost some time. Now, he will argue, Colin would argue that he was going to catch us, and Richard would argue that he wasn't going to catch us. And unfortunately, we'll never fully know. But, you know, staying on the road is part of the game, and the result is, you know, what the result was.
I wasn't going to touch upon it until a bit later, but the Colin and Richard dynamic obviously defined the end of the season in particular, but it was a big thing at the time for particularly UK rally fans, because here you had almost two completely polarising characters, one from Scotland, one from England, and they were both at the very top of their game fighting for the World Championship. But it often seems to get portrayed that there was some massive bitterness, where really, in reality, it was just jovial fun for the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, I think I think Richard was a bit of an unlikely success in rallying. You know, first generation rallying. His parents were not particularly wealthy. And he got there through a lot of hard work, meeting the right people, clearly having the best co-driver.
Goes without saying.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the if you'd looked at how the history books might have been written before Richard, it's, you know, Colin was there, Alistair was coming along, and that's just how it was going to be. And so I think Richard kind of upset the form book a little bit in what he did. And even though he kind of had some good performances early on, there's a lot of people never really thought that he had what it took. But, you know, you look at that 99, 2000, 2001, I mean, you know, most number of fastest times 3 years running. So the speed was there, and it's often something that I think is forgotten about with Richard, that, you know, everybody says, oh, he was really consistent and he picked up points, and, you know, if Colin crashed, he would win, and all these sorts of things. But that wasn't always the case. But I think you're right, there was a bit of this kind of English-Scottish, and I was obviously stuck in the middle with that one being the Scot co-driving for the Englishman. But I think it was the flamboyance versus the calculation. And there are a few people that would say, you know, I'll support any of the Brits that are winning. But I think most people would be in that, I really like Richard because he's a thinking driver, or I really like Colin because of how sideways he goes. So they were quite polarising from a fan perspective. So I think it's only natural that that polarisation kind of continued over in the media. And what people thought. But, you know, it would have been unusual for us at that time not to have dinner at least one night with Colin on the recce. I mean, I'd known Colin for years before I knew Richard. So, you know, we'd been, I can't remember if it was that year in New Zealand or the year before, we went to South Africa for Robbie Head's wedding. And Colin and Alison and Richard and Zoe, so it must have been 2001, rented a house together in Camps Bay in Cape Town, and like stayed with each other in the house for 10 days. Now, they probably were closer to falling out or doing something nasty to each other after 10 days of living in the same house than they ever were, you know, rallying against each other for years. But no, they got on really well.
I assume there must have been, as there are with all drivers, I guess, at that level, but there would have been a massive amount of respect between the two of them for what each other were doing as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Colin would often come up and say, fair play, Burnsie, that was a good time. You know, or well done. And even when we won, you know, Colin was home in Scotland, but he was one of the first people on the phone. So, yeah, there was a huge amount of mutual respect.
Okay, so we'll move on from New Zealand and we go to San Remo next, which was a little bit of a crash back down to earth, literally, I guess.
Literally, yeah.
What are your memories of that weekend? Was that a bit of a bitter blow, that one, to swallow?
It was. I mean, we had a tyre delaminate on the way to the first stage, changed it before the first stage, and had another one delaminate in the stage. So it's kind of one of these things. What can you do? You know, Pirelli had been really good for us in a lot of events. That was one event it didn't work out. So, you know, you're there as a partnership, as a whole team. So you just got to suck it up, really.
I've not got too much else to add there, have we?
No, I mean, we were back at the swimming pool drinking beers in San Remo by the time the cars were at stage three, I think.
There are at least worse places in the world to be having some time off, I guess.
Yeah, it was sunny.
Corsica next, another Mediterranean tarmac rally. This one, fourth overall. I think in the end, you can correct me with this, Robert, but did you end up passing Petter in the final stage for extra points?
So yeah.
That was, yeah. Was that a manufactured thing, or was that a pace, just complete driver versus driver?
No, I mean, we're entered as a team. Petter had an even more disastrous season than we had. You know, I think, I can't remember the ins and outs, but I wouldn't have been surprised if Petter had suggested it rather than, you know, been told and done it against his will. I mean, that's just, you know, every championship win, excuse me, will have some story behind it of, you know, people saying, oh, well, if this hadn't happened, you wouldn't have won. If that hadn't happened, you wouldn't have won. And, you know, maybe that's our story in this one. But, yeah, I mean, it was, the points mattered at the end of the day. If we hadn't had them, we would have had to win.
Yeah.
And GB, even with Colin going out, not impossible. Might actually have been less pressure because having to finish third or fourth, wherever it was a lot of pressure. Whereas just going to win on an event that we knew well, you know, might have actually been in some ways more relaxing.
Yeah. So either way, it was quite an important weekend championship-wise again, because Tommy obviously had his massive accident. I can't remember precisely, but I'm pretty sure the top three was filled with non-championship contenders. So you were the top of that pile.
Yeah.
So they were important points secured, and as you said, that made a difference at the end of the year. Yeah. But we had Australia next. Another good rally in the end, actually second. But there's obviously a famous incident at the end of the first day as well, which probably cost McRae a chance at winning. Do you think that is, looking back, one of the key moments that sort of swayed the season almost? Because if he hadn't have had the issue, he could well have been much further up in Australia and in a much stronger position for GB.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably umpteen different, you know, things that you can say. You know, if our car didn't break down in Monte Carlo, if we didn't get in a snowbank in Sweden, you know, there would have been different factors. But yeah, I mean, it was a really odd situation. I mean, at that point, there was a lot of talk about road position, and the organisers in Australia came up with their own system to try and kind of mitigate against it, but also add some extra razzmatazz to it. We were, you know, in our briefing before we left the UK, it was hammered home to us how important that moment was. In the briefing before the event, it was hammered home. John Spiller, the team manager, literally took the drivers by the scruff of the neck and made sure they were there on time. I don't know what the Colin situation was, but he arrived late and the decision had been made by that point.
Yeah, I should point out for context, actually, because I forgot to mention it. Essentially, this was, I think, the end of the first leg, wasn't it? There was a road order selection and Colin arrived late, so he had to then start first on the road for the next day and was denied the chance of choosing his position. But obviously for you were second and it was again behind Marcus, so that didn't really matter to you, did it? Because he wasn't in the fight, I don't think, mathematically even by then. So.
No, I mean, it didn't matter, but it did. I mean, you know, you got to remember that's 6 points to 10 points.
Yeah, fair
point. The way the championship points were at that point. You know, there was a big bonus for actually winning.
Okay. So we go into the season finale, and this is where we get a bit more detailed, I think. This is what everybody probably wants to hear about. It's what we all remember. You were in the fight. Colin was at the head of the field. You were a few points back. It essentially was anybody of any of four drivers for the taking. You had Tommy and Carlos, but it realistically was between you, Richard, Colin and Nicky, because of your experience, I guess, on that home rally. But in the lead up to that, can you remember anything that had sort of more hype and interest from I guess the wider non-rallying public than you had for that weekend?
I think it was exasperated for us because there was a contractual battle going on at the same time, so it was huge amounts of pressure. Rally GB always was huge amounts of pressure just because of the interest. I think I'm right in saying there was a picture of a World Rally car on the front page of the Times 3 out of 4 days of the event. You know, I mean, we were getting more column inches than Damon had in winning Formula One World Championship in 96. So it was a really big thing. It was a really big thing for rallying, never mind British rallying, to have this battle going on. We knew what we had to do. Interestingly, I don't, and not being arrogant in saying this, but I don't remember thinking much about Tommy and Carlos. You know, it was Richard Collin, that seemed to be the focus. And we knew what McRae's tactic would be. He'd try and do what he did in Argentina. So we knew we couldn't let that happen. But also we knew that it was a long event, and you know, as long as we were within a handful of seconds, then that was always going to be good, and not letting him pull away. And you know, he took a couple of seconds out of us in the first stage in Cardiff, and then the first Forest stage he took a few, and then we took a tenth back or something, basically matched him, and then the fourth stage, we passed a steaming wreck at the side of the road.
Before we get into that, I just wanted to touch a little bit on the psychology of sort of around the rally as well, because you and I have spoken about it before for something else, about how Richard essentially made sure that Colin could see him having a conversation with his sports psychologist. So there was a lot of this going on, because obviously the two of them, as we've touched upon already, had a little bit of this psyche going on anyway, but the stakes could not have been higher than they were that weekend.
No, and I think the interesting thing with Colin is that for those of us that knew him, he wasn't necessarily how he liked to come across. So, you know, he was the type of guy who, you know, he liked setting a fastest time in Bursey and Monte Carlo without having wrecked the stage that year. You know, he liked this image that he never did any physical training. He liked the image his pace notes were simple and he didn't really have to put much effort in. But he put a lot of effort in. Whereas Richard was the other way around. You know, Richard was the type of guy who was putting maximum effort in all the time. And yeah, there was, in fact, the stage before, I'm not saying it's the reason that Colin crashed and we went on to win the championship, but we were stopped at the side of the road having a conversation with Richard's sports psychologist. And the conversation was probably about the weather.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's... sports psychologists can't really do much tweaking once the event starts. All the work's done beforehand. But, you know, Richard felt that being seen to be putting much more effort in than he felt Colin would put was a psychological advantage.
Was there anything different about his demeanour, I guess, that weekend? Because there was a lot on the line, and it's probably fair to say it was your best shot at that point of winning the championship, which you ultimately managed to do. But did he seem in any way different or distracted or even fazed by it all? Or was it just the exact same approach and the exact same sort of relaxation for the rally?
Yeah, I mean, he was intense. He refused to do media interviews at the shakedown, which caused a bit of a stushy. He just wanted to concentrate on what was going on. I mean, we had our manager there the whole weekend because they were trying to sort out some contractual stuff. So that was distracting. We stayed in a different hotel from the team because he didn't want to be distracted with all the stuff that was going on. So yeah, it was a strange weekend, very strange weekend. But then we had, you know, some friends there and some family there. And it was, in some ways, it was a nice weekend because of that. So Dario Franchitti and his brother Marino were there. I think McDoon was there as well from memory, and you know, a few others that had come along just to kind of support the cause. So it was different. It was definitely a different weekend.
We'll get on to the Franchitti brothers in a few minutes, I'm sure. But stage four, you mentioned it, you passed, as you called it, the steaming wreck of Colin's car. The next junction down, you and Richard obviously have a moment of your own, but is that purely just because it's the shock of suddenly knowing the position you're in? Because at this point, obviously, Carlos is way back and Tom was already out the rally.
Yeah, I think in the in-car, I say to him, concentrate, and he says, you concentrate. So, you know, I think it was just, as you say, a realisation that that Colin was out, and he clearly wasn't going anywhere after that. There was, I think, a bit of concern over, you know, if he was okay, because it was a big shunt. And it was then he kind of reset your brain, reset your mind into, okay, well, now what we have to do is finish in, you know, this position. The interesting thing was that we weren't as dominant. You know, Colin and Richard, you would think, going into a dogfight in GB on Pirellis, on an event that they know well, they would have been head and shoulders above everyone else. But Marcus was actually quicker than everybody. And I think Didier was even up there at the beginning as well. So, you know, I've certainly read something had rattled Colin. And he, you know, he was certainly fazed by the fact that he wasn't as quick as he thought he would be against everybody. I don't remember it rattling Richard particularly, but the irony of it is that when McRae went out, we still had to do the same thing as we've been doing because there were still people ahead of us. And, you know, Marcus, Harry, these guys, I mean, I think Alistair was up there as well, wasn't he? So, you know, we still had a job to do that wasn't particularly easy. And it wasn't an easy event. I mean, I often gauge these events by how many times coming out of a service I go in the car to the out control as opposed to walk to the out control. And I think I walk to the out control every service, because when you walk to the out control, you can put your card on the table when the car comes, you know, to the control, rather than having to get out the car and go and put your card on the table. So you save yourself 10 or 15 seconds sometimes. And I think I walked to the out control every time. There was always, you know, the last few seconds of the minute we were getting to time controls. And we had some hassles. We did, you know, two stages in the dark in the first night with no map light, because the guys have forgotten to put the map light in. I had a mini mag light torch tie wrapped to my thumb. So, you know, there was a whole load of things that could easily have gone really, really wrong that didn't, or that we managed to mitigate as best we can and get through it all.
There was obviously that incident, I can't remember which morning it was, I think it was the penultimate leg where the car wouldn't start in Parc Fermé as well, which is just exactly precisely what you don't need in that situation.
Yeah, by that time Richard was an expert at changing spark plugs on a boxer engine, which, as you can imagine, when they're pointing at the chassis legs, isn't the easiest thing. But we'd done it a couple of times during the year. So, it's, you know, looking back at it, it all just seemed, it was like, oh, here we go again, rather than, oh, panic. You know, it was just, okay, we've got enough time, let's just sort this out and head down, and very, very in this bubble. You know, there's lots of things that were probably going on round about that you were just kind of blanking out. You know, you didn't have the capacity to deal with all that as well as what was going on the event.
And what was the atmosphere like in the team as well at this point? Because you mentioned there was a situation bubbling with contracts and stuff, but did that take the shine off what you were achieving, the fact that there was this sort of cloud hanging over what you were doing, or was that at the back of your mind throughout the rally?
I think it's always at the back of your mind, but, you know, I mean, we were quite clear, if we get a chance to win the championship, we're going to win the championship and sort it out after that. The team were generally really good. You know, there's a couple of incidences of flashpoints, but nothing too much. You know, I think everybody was in that same situation. I mean, at the end of the day, nobody wanted not to win. So, you know, just the common goal at that point to win was the overriding factor. And we just all got on with it.
And just for, I guess, for context, well, in case anyone doesn't know, that was the stipulation in the sort of issue, wasn't it? In that if you had won the championship, then your contract, or that's what a negotiation was, is that Subaru were then going to try and commit you to 2002 win.
Yeah, if we won the championship, we had to stay. If we didn't win the championship, we could go. So we'd already committed to going. You know, and ultimately I wasn't party to the final negotiation that allowed both those things to happen. But that was some weeks after the event.
So final day of the rally now, you're in the situation you need to be. So you've only got a few stages left, but of course in rallying it's never just a few stages, particularly when you're in that situation. What was that morning like, I guess, on the edge of glory, so to speak? Were you nervous? Was anything feel different, or was it just another day at the office for you?
So this is probably going to sound a bit strange, but for me, I woke up anxious because I didn't know if in winning the championship I would want to go and do it again, or whether that was the dream. You know, the dream had always been win the championship. So what happens when you win the championship? It's a bit like the old expression of the dog chasing the bus. You know, when the bus stops at the bus stop and the dog catches it up, and it's then got a very blank look on its face because it doesn't know what to do next. And certainly for me, there was a large part of that. I was like, I have literally worked for, you know, more than a decade to get to this moment. What happens when I achieve it? Do I wake up tomorrow morning going, right, I now want to be a farmer or a whatever? Or do I wake up the next morning going, this is brilliant, I want to do this again? Thankfully, it was, this is brilliant, I want to do it again. But, you know, it's just strange how some of these things go through your mind. And it's almost as that, it's that situation, you know, even, you know, sitting having some food the night before, everybody's thinking the same thing, which is, don't mention it, don't talk about it. You know, so everybody's trying not to talk about it. And in trying not to talk about it, invariably you end up talking about it or saying something. Or so there was quite a lot of edginess definitely about it.
It is quite strange how you won it, I guess, as well, because it was this massive four-way or two-way, how you look at it, but it was a big title fight anyway. But it ended up being over after just a few stages. So all you could sort of do at that point was lose it, really.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And we had, you know, 2.5 days to lose it at that point. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, and, you know, I'm sure both Colin and Richard would agree, it would have been much better had it been a fight all the way through, you know, and both will believe that they would have come out on top. Unfortunately, that wasn't the way it was decided. But, it was a long event.
So obviously things did come good in the end, as we touched on at the start of the podcast, and of course everybody knows you won the World Championship. We all know what happened at the finish line. Talk to us about what happened on the way back from Argham to Cardiff, because I understand there was a bit of fun on the M4.
Yeah, well, I was on the phone to Fred Gallagher, as clerk of the course, because there was some traffic, and just trying to say, Fred, you need to cancel road penalties. What happens if we're late? And he's like, don't worry, and doing all the co-driver stuff. And then I think from memory, I can't remember if we felt a slight nudge from behind or was the other way around, but the Franchitti brothers in Richard's road car had caught up with us on the motorway. So there was a wee bit of drag racing went on, and a bit of jostling for position, shall we say.
Oh, at 77 miles an hour, I assume.
Well, 70. You know, we're not taking a risk with the threshold at that point.
No, that's a good point. So you get to the end of the rally, you celebrate a success. Did it ever sink in? And if it did, how long did it take for you to realise that you'd both achieved what you had achieved?
I think the next day, so we went down to London the next day, and we did some filming at Marble Arch. So just driving the car through the arch and roundabout and whatever, and some pictures, which was rather painful with a big hangover. And we're eternally grateful for Warren Hunt for driving us down to London the next day. And it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience for him, because I don't think Rich and I were saying too much. We were suffering and popping paracetamols at that point. So I think, you know, it's at times like that, you know, and then you get other moments. So obviously there's a court case going on, but, you know, we went to the Sports Personality Awards, And we sat down there and we got a tap on the shoulder and it's Bernie Eccleston behind us, you know, saying, well done, guys. And then you go to the FIA prize giving, which was in Monaco that year. You know, you go to the Autosport Awards. So you've got all these kind of moments that kind of seem to almost like consolidate it or like really bring it to life. Because at the time, I mean, certainly for me, I was one of these types of people that blinkers on at the start of the event and then have a bit of a blowout at the end.
Yeah.
So Richard was much more able to sit down and have a cup of tea at the end of a rally and I think he kind of diffused the pressure in different ways than I did. But, you know, it was like a decade-long pressure cooker that the steam was let off at the end of that event. And, you know, these awards dinners and celebrations that happened afterwards were the ones that kind of brought it all home.
How was the atmosphere celebrating with the team at that time, given that there's a little bit of sort of not rivalry, I think that's too strong a word, but there's other factors ongoing, so was it quite kind of a strange way to win a world championship, I guess?
Yeah, it was a little bit. I mean, we went and had dinner, and then Claire, Richard's PA, had organised a limo to take us down in the middle of town, and the team were all there. I mean, you know, we had no beef with the team at all. I think the emotions of winning overrode anything else that you know, could have been at the time. And I think there was almost a resolve that, okay, we'll celebrate tonight and then the next phase will start when the next phase starts.
And looking back at the season, again, it's another cliche question for you, Robert, but do you think that was yours and Richard's best year of rallying, or were there others that come close to, or maybe even better in terms of a season-long performance?
I suppose it just depends how you define it, isn't it? I mean, the 99 and 2000, we won four events each that year. You know, in some ways, 2003, up until the middle of the year, was, you know, an absolute masterclass in consistency. So, yes, it is the best because that's what the record books show. But I think there were other times that were pretty close.
And how does it feel, I guess, we touched on it at the start of the podcast, but it has been 20 years. Do you think you'll ever sort of stop looking back at it and smiling? Because it can never be a bad thing to know that you won the World Championship. You achieved what the life goal was.
If you look across here, this is the World Championship trophy sat on my sideboard.
Do you know, I didn't even notice that when I came in.
And it's got masks and keys and an invitation to the Autosport Awards this year in it. So it's where everything gets tossed into when I come in the door. And in some ways that's intentional, because I want it to be part of everyday life. You know, I don't want it to be something on a pedestal. And I want, looking back at it, I want it to be part of who I am, but not define who I am.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually, because obviously you are doing lots of things now with rallying involved, but it's not the only thing you want to be known for, is it? You don't want to be just known as the guy that won a world championship and that's it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, people that know me well often joke that I don't pull the world champion card that often, but when it's necessary, I'll do it. So, you know, it's, as I say, it doesn't define who I am, but it's certainly part of what led me to be where I am today.
And a popular fan question to conclude, I think a lot of people think that 2001 was possibly the best season the WRC has ever had. It's probably harder for you to answer that because you obviously had a very personal involvement in how things went down, but would you go along with that view, that it was one of the most entertaining we've ever seen?
Yeah, I think I would. And, you know, reflecting on it now, I mean, I think if you have, I mean, in those days, there wasn't many events that there were less than four or five people could win. So if you have a whole series of events with a number of different permutations of who can win, four drivers going into the championship decider being able to win the title, I think that's the ultimate of what we want to be. You know, the right person should always win. You know, the person who's been fastest during the year. But I think if there's some unknowns in there, and I think road order is one of these things that gives you that. You know, if you always hand the advantage to the person who's in the lead, you end up in a racing type scenario. You know, you win quali, you start on pole. If you always hand somebody who is fastest at the beginning of an event the advantage each day going forward in the event, you end up with big gaps. So certainly small margins and lots of people in contention, I think, are what makes for an exciting championship.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you reliving all of that with us, and I appreciate the invite into your home to do it as well. It's been wonderful.
Great. Thank you very much.